virtually all the arguments about the socially disorganizing effects of marriage were made about civil unions in Vermont 4 years ago. Today, civil unions in Vermont are boring to all of the people who aren't in them and given human nature to a few of the people who are. But they have had no negative social impacts whatsoever.
That's Congressman Barney Frank, of course, testifying at a House Judiciary Subcommittee hearing on the issue of gay marriage, obviously saying, look, what's the big deal? Civil unions in Vermont didn't do us any harm. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Of course, the topic during this 25 minutes, gay marriage. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking with Dr. Christopher Wolf. He's professor of political science at Marquette University in Milwaukee. He's editor and contributor to the books Homosexuality in American Public Life and a second volume in that series, Same Sex Matters. Dr. Christopher Wolf, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Wolf, give us your thoughts on what Congressman Frank had to say there in that little soundbite.
Well, I mean, it sounds as if he expects that there would be some, you know, a very obvious or direct impact or harm that could be measured when he says that nothing has happened as a result of the civil unions in Vermont. But the fact of the matter is that we're not arguing, those of us who are opposed to gay marriage, that there's some kind of direct or tangible immediate harm that results. The key thing has to do with our whole understanding of marriage, and civil unions in Vermont, together with a lot of other things that involve a very broad change in the understanding of marriage in this country, has clearly, I think, had a negative impact on marriage overall. I mean, that the gay marriage is simply the last or the most recent step that comes from changes that go back at least till the 1960s, when the whole notion of what marriage is about changed fundamentally. And with the result that, as we look around today, we see that marriage is clearly, you know, much weaker than it once was, and many children of marriage are not raised by both a mother and a father, which is pretty clearly the optimal situation.
I was intrigued by something that Congressman Frank had to say there at the opening part of his comment, where and this says, well, you know, not only is it no big deal socially, people are not even batting an eye anymore after 4 years of civil unions in Vermont. I was talking just a few minutes ago to someone off air, and they said on the issue of this gay marriage, they said, well, the goal here is to go from yuck to yes to so what? To apathy about gay marriage. Do you concur?
Yeah, I think that's their goal for sure. I think a great example is what has happened to divorce over time. You know, divorce was originally tolerated in very few kind of exceptional cases. Even, you know, when I was a young boy growing up, it was the kind of thing that was allowed, but in some cases. But it was something that was still, you know, clearly unfortunate. People didn't talk about it very much. And now it's really become integral to our whole way of life. It's extremely commonplace, and we just take it for granted. In fact, at the college where one of my kids went to, which shall remain nameless, it was almost expected as a kind of part of life. It's just what happens. And that's precisely that kind of acceptance of the phenomenon as just an ordinary part of life is precisely what they're aiming at. And, of course, that's precisely why some of us oppose the legitimization of gay marriage, because it will try to treat as normal or ordinary something that really is an abnormality, a very unfortunate kind of affliction that people suffer from.
Is that really the goal here? Not so much to be able to partake of the bonds of matrimony as a gay couple, but to partake of public approval that accrues to a legal recognition of gay marriage?
Well, certainly they go together for some people. I mean, there's no question that there are some homosexual couples who really, you know, do love each other subjectively in a very sincere way, and they want to have, in a way, the kind of ultimate sign of that by, you know, committing themselves to each other in a way that mirrors marriage. At the same time, I think it's also true, as you suggest, indirectly there, that a lot of homosexual activists who are pushing for gay marriage are really doing it not because they care about marriage per se, but because their exclusion from marriage is a sign that they are not fully accepted by society. And so, marriage is really a kind of means to an end. It's a means to the legitimization of homosexuality rather than something that's desired for itself.
Now, is this why you think, do you think, Dr. Wolf, where same-sex unions were approved in Vermont, the numbers that availed themselves of that opportunity were really relatively low?
Yeah, I think that is that's quite true. And I think it's true not only of the civil unions of Vermont. I think it's also true of gay marriages in places like Holland where they've been approved. I mean, there are a lot of homosexuals who want marriage, but there are a lot of homosexuals who, in principle, are opposed to marriage, viewing it as a kind of corrupt and rigid institution of heterosexuals that shouldn't be imposed on them. And so, obviously, you know, in any group of people, you're going to get, you know, diverse subgroups. But there's no question that there are a lot of homosexuals who are not interested in marriage as we, you know, have traditionally understood heterosexual marriage with its exclusivity and a presumptive permanence.
Given what you know about homosexuality and the nature of the relationships that are forged there, even apart from civil unions and gay marriage in Massachusetts, when they talk about enduring monogamous, faithful relationships, should we take that at face value?
Well, I mean, some of them, again, you have to recognize that there are some people who are quite sincere about that. On the other hand, it's very striking that the understanding of monogamy and fidelity in at least some portions of the homosexual community is really quite different from what traditionally those notions have meant. For example, you know, Andrew Sullivan, who wrote a book called Virtually Normal, which is a kind of conservative case for gay marriage, you know, talks about, you know, the advantages of kind of monogamy, the advantages of gay marriage as a way of kind of regularizing the sexual impulse and, in fact, taming it in some ways. But then at the end of his book, he also makes it very clear that what he means by monogamy and fidelity doesn't involve, in fact, strict sexual exclusivity or fidelity, that, in fact, the homosexual sexual relationships, even when they involved what are called permanent bonds, are open to the possibility of other sexual outlets and sexual activity with other people, at least on various occasions. And that's a, you know, quite different understanding of monogamy and fidelity.
Dr. Christopher Wolf is our guest. We're talking about gay marriage in Massachusetts, which is now a legal fact there. Dr. Wolf, I'd like your response again to Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts. He says that the alarmists on the issue of gay marriage, their predictions are not going to come to pass.
A year from now, I hope you will convene this hearing again and we can see whose predictions were right. I say no polygamy. There will not be a full faith and credit clause. The Supreme Court of the United States is not going to require this. There's not going to be an increase in the divorce rate. There are going to be thousands and thousands of people married in Massachusetts. Most of them will live happily ever after. Some of them won't, and that'll be it.
Okay, he's making predictions of his own. What do you make of them, Dr.
Well, that's a real laundry list. To go through some of them, I would say there's a virtually 100% chance that, in fact, there will be a suit under the full faith and credit clause trying to get other states to be compelled to recognize Massachusetts marriages. I think that's absolutely certain to come. I don't know that it will be within the next year that there'll be a demand at the Supreme Court level for gay marriage, but it'll be very soon. If it's not the next year, it'll be the next few years. And there's at least a reasonably decent chance that the Supreme Court will follow the Massachusetts court. So I think he's clearly wrong on those two things. He says, you know, most of those gay marriages in Massachusetts, they'll live happily ever after. Well, I don't know what exactly he means by most. If he means 50% plus one, I suppose there's a chance of that, but I'd say at the very least there are substantial doubts about exactly what proportion will live happily ever after, as opposed to the people that, you know, live happily for the next 10 years and then get divorced. You know, and of course one has to acknowledge at the same time that the situation among heterosexuals in this regard is pretty deplorable as well. So it's not just the impermanence of homosexual combinations that are something to be deplored. And of course, you know, whether the divorce rate will go up in the next year. So, I mean, we're talking about changes that don't necessarily occur over a year. You know, the whole situation of the family breakdown in this country took a long time to develop. There's no question that no-fault divorce had a tremendous impact. And certainly the number of divorces that occurred after no-fault divorce was approved, let's say the first year after that, went up. But I think that probably pales before the long-term changes over a 20 or 30-year period that succeeded when we saw the divorce rate go up quite dramatically. And I think, of course, it's hard to know exactly whether the divorce rate is going to go up dramatically given how incredibly high it is already. But it's certainly going to confirm those changes and make it difficult to turn around.
We saw this in California and Oregon and several other states as well, and attempts made on the local level about a month or two ago when local clerks, mayors, San Francisco mayor most notably said, look, we're just going to give out gay marriage licenses, period, regardless of what the law may or may not say. And what struck me there, and I heard no one talk about this, not to my personal knowledge, is the many who went there to get married, yeah, they love each other, but it was as much an act of civil disobedience, civil protest, political activism. Talk about marriage as political activism.
Well, I mean, actually, the thing that struck me about that event was that a lot of the people who were very laudatory of the civil disobedience in that case had conniptions a few months earlier when Judge Roy Moore had engaged in some civil disobedience, refusing to take down a statue in the Alabama state capitol that had religious significance, and they were just outraged that anybody would disobey a federal law or a federal court order in that case. And it suggests that attitudes towards civil disobedience can sometimes be rather result-oriented, depending upon whether people like the particular policy consequences of it. I mean, I think there's no question that the civil disobedience was simply a deliberate flouting of the law. Obviously, that was used as a way of trying to advance their cause further. Again, it's part of this general pattern of trying to achieve a legitimization of homosexuality in our society. And there's no question that there's a significant, public majority that's opposed to gay marriage. The problem is that judges are effectively beyond immediate political control, and there are just an awful lot of judges these days that have the souls of tyrants, that they are convinced that they're doing wonderful things and they're not going to let the law get in their way.
Barney Frank mentioned polygamy as one of the outcomes he said would not be a result of gay marriage in Massachusetts and the push toward that. But a new word has entered the American lexicon of late on that issue. And that word is polyamory. What is it, and why might it be a result?
Well, polyamory is different from polygamy because polygamy is largely associated with past multiple marriages in which you had a kind of male domination, I think. And I think polyamory is to distinguish it from that. But it's essentially still, polygamy, multiple marriages. And I think Frank is right in this sense that probably it won't be legitimized in the next year. But I think that there's a reasonably good chance that you're going to see significant pressure to recognize multiple marriages within the next decade, because the logic of simply defining marriage to suit our own tastes is so implicit in the gay marriage movement. I'm not sure how many people will want to have multiple partners, but there's certainly a vocal small minority out there now that's pushing for it. And I think that, frankly, the approval of gay marriage is going to help their cause.
There is a law in Massachusetts, I believe dating to 1913 or thereabouts, that forbids marriage licenses to those from out of state, wherein those states, the marriage being performed in Massachusetts, would be considered illegal. Governor Mitt Romney has promised to revive and apply this law in this case. Could that be the trigger for this becoming a Supreme Court issue, not a challenge to gay marriage, but a challenge to that law in light of the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution?
Of course it could. I mean, whether it will be successful or not, it's hard to know. There's certainly the possibility of forum shopping, doing pursuing suits of this sort in various jurisdictions throughout the country until you find a sympathetic federal judge and then trying to appeal it on up. You know, again, whether it'll be successful in the short run, I don't know, but certainly the advocates of gay marriage, I think, who are poo-pooing the idea of the full faith and credit court clause being used today, a year or two down the road when those cases start to arise, I think will vocally be on the side of those who want to use it to try to impose gay marriage on the country.
Is that the intent of the full faith and credit clause?
Of course not. I mean, there's certainly, you know, no question that there was no understanding of that sort. Most importantly, however, is the fact that Congress, you know, has jurisdiction over that. It can limit, you know, what kinds of things require full faith and credit. And with the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996, they made it quite clear that no other state has to recognize anything other than a union between a man and a woman as a marriage. But again, that's going to be challenged in court, and you can certainly imagine some judges striking it down.
One of the things that strikes almost everyone on both sides of this issue of gay marriage, but everyone admits to the fact that this has come upon us like a spring thunderstorm. Apparently, quiet, calm, low winds. The next thing you know, gay marriage is a legality in Massachusetts, and it all happened within the span of 1 year. Has it really come upon us that quickly, or was it brewing for a long time before?
Oh, it's been brewing for a while. I mean, there was no fundamental distinction between civil unions in Vermont and marriage, gay marriage, other than the name. You know, the laws of Vermont said, in effect, that it was everything but marriage in name. And so it's obviously, you know, something that's been brewing for a while. And in that sense, it didn't occur overnight. I mean, the key thing here is just that you get these judges who aren't bound by law, who feel free to make up the law as they go in order to pursue their ideas of what is just and noble. And they can simply impose that. And frankly, you know, the American people, a lot of them, simply have much too much respect for the judicial office, still laboring under the misimpression that the judges actually interpret the law rather than making it up as they go along. And you know, given the combination of those people in the middle who don't want to touch the judiciary because of that misunderstanding, and those people who have a kind of vested interest in the judiciary's you know, willful impositions of social policy on the nation, it just makes it almost impossible to use the very limited mechanisms for restricting judges that do exist. It's something that's, you know, if you have any kind of serious belief in democracy, it's just utterly frustrating to watch this because it's really, frankly, an outrage what federal judges are getting away with.
Given
federal, state too, as well, of course, as in Massachusetts.
Given the makeup of the judiciary at all the levels, and given the penchant toward judicial activism, another newly coined term, what do you think will be the picture in the United States for gay marriage 20 years from today?
Well, the key thing right now is that at least the opinion polls suggest that older people are much more likely to be opposed to gay marriage and younger people to be in favor of it. Which means, you know, if you wait, you know, if you project that out for 20 years, chances are overwhelming that gay marriage will be widely accepted throughout the country, and that even if the judiciary were to get out of it, that legislatures probably would not act to preserve marriage in its traditional form. That's one reason why it's so key, so important, to try to do something now and to use this debate as an occasion for educating people, and especially young people, many of whom know very little about the issue, only know about it what they see in their sitcoms and TVs, and which is presenting a terribly one-sided view of the issue to them. I mean, how many young kids know just about the sheer physical threats that homosexuality poses to male homosexuals, especially, you know, that the life expectancy of male homosexuals is dramatically, probably decades shorter than that of other people. I mean, this is the kind of information that's, you know, nobody's talking about and that they never see, and so it's probably not surprising that they, you know, having only seen, you know, these very sympathetic portrayal of gay characters on TV and in movies, that they support the move toward gay marriage. So this is a time that's really crucial. It's just essential that people who favor traditional marriage get out and get information about the issue, that they'd be able to articulate in a reasonable and calm way what the arguments for traditional marriage are, and really, you know, act very strongly right now, because this is really, you know, the window of opportunity we have to try to deal with the issue.
Before we let you go, Dr. Wolf, I'd like your response to something that retired Judge Robert Bork had to say on the issue of gay marriage.
Most court watchers believe that within, say, 2 to 3 years, the Supreme Court of the United States will hold that there is a federal constitutional right to homosexual marriage.
Your thoughts on this, Dr. Wolf?
It's very likely. With people like Anthony Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor on the court, who tend to be somewhat sympathetic to the gay rights agenda, if not quite fully embracing it as much as other people, as long as they think they can get away with it without getting slapped down, you know, if it does seem that this, the Massachusetts decision kind of slowly becomes, you know, legitimized or accepted widely, I think when the court feels that they can get away with doing it, they will do that.
With only a minute here, Dr. Wolf, what do you make of the American public as it's polled on this, where they say no to gay marriage, but they generally will say in equal proportions yes to civil unions?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a lot of intellectual consistency here. I mean, most people have some kind of sense that marriage really is different, and they probably can't articulate it very well. They know it enough, though, to know that usually it involves family and children, and that the homosexual relationship, even if they don't want to go out and do anything about it, they kind of recognize that there's something kind of abnormal about it, and so they're kind of willing to tolerate homosexuals and even their unions, but they're just not willing to give it the full approval of the law that gay marriage would give it. And you know, it reflects, I guess, the deep ambivalence of Americans on issues like this. It's not just on gay marriage, it's on many other issues as well, that they're kind of pulled in two different directions and kind of want to have their cake and eat it too. And you know, that the fact that there are a lot of people like that in the middle is one reason why we have had this kind of slow but continuous slide into more and more, frankly, decadent, you know, morality regarding marriage and sexuality.
Dr. Christopher Wolf is professor of political science at Marquette University in Milwaukee. Dr. Wolf, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
You're very welcome, Todd. Just one thing before I leave is those people who do want to familiarize themselves with the issues, you know, I've edited two books on this subject based on a conference we held in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, and it really kind of covers a wide range of issues regarding homosexuality. And your listeners can get those books for a 50% discount at spencepublishing.com or by calling 1-888-773-6782.
Dr. Wolf, thank you again. The books are called Homosexuality in American Public Life and the other one, Same Sex Matters, spencepublishing.com, www.spencepublishing.com, or call Spence Publishing toll-free at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. The books, Homosexuality in American Public Life and Same Sex Matters. When we come back, is gay marriage a possibility in Missouri? We'll find out when we talk with Representative Jim Lemke.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Jesus tells his opponents in John chapter 5, "You search the scriptures because you think that by them you have eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me." What did Jesus mean? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is titled, "Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center." It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Daniel Preuss. For more information on the book, visit our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. "Why I Am a Lutheran" is published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. What does it mean that Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega? Find out with "Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center" by Pastor Daniel Preuss. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. "Why I Am a Lutheran," our Issues Etc. book of the month for May.
Metal-like reptiles, are they evolutionary? Answers with Ken Ham, one of the authors of the Answers book. Well, Ken, what are those so-called mammal-like reptiles?
Well, if evolution were true and one kind of animal changed into another over millions of years, there should be millions of creatures that were intermediate or transitional forms. They should show evidence of features that haven't fully developed. Now, creationists have always claimed that there are no transitional forms anywhere in the world. Evolutionists, though, say the fossils of some creatures they found show features that are mammal-like, and yet they were reptiles. These must be transitional forms, they say. But these creatures had no partly formed or transitional structures. They were fully developed and obviously fully functional. Besides which, so what if an animal has some features similar to another group? Look at the platypus from Australia. It has features like reptiles, birds, and mammals. No one would ever claim it to be transitional because we can observe it in the world today. Even many evolutionists, in their own writings, admit that there are no transitional forms to make a watertight argument. You know what? You can believe the book of Genesis. God made separate kinds, just as the evidence shows.
In his brand new booklet, Ken Ham will show you how scientific evidence supports the Bible's very first book. Read his Seven Seas of History right on your computer screen when you log on to AnswersRadio.com. It's a free service of the radio ministry of AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Physical activity is important for young, growing bodies. Exercise helps the muscles, the lungs, the heart, and the mind. But for every minute your child sits in front of the TV, that is time away from running, jumping, and playing. To make sure your children get enough exercise, you may have to turn off the TV and play with them. That may mean going for a walk, throwing a ball, or playing tag. That is good for your children. It's good for you, and it's good for your relationship. Jesus loves your children enough to die on the cross for them. He also wants them to get the exercise they need. When you turn off the TV and actively play with your child, the love of God works through you to help your child become strong and healthy. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. We just spent a few minutes talking with Dr. Christopher Wolfe about gay marriage in Massachusetts. You know, this has kind of put the fear of God into a lot of people. And say, folks all over the United States are saying, now, wait a minute. Yeah, Massachusetts might be left-leaning in its politics. It might be innovative in the way it thinks about these social and public issues. But what about my state? What about middle America? What about Missouri? We're going to talk about gay marriage in Missouri for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. Representative Jim Lemke, State Representative Jim Lemke of the 85th Legislative District in Missouri, has been kind enough to join us to bring us his thoughts on this issue. Jim, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, always good to be with you.
Well, what about the possibility of gay marriage eventually coming to Missouri in the same form that it's come to Massachusetts as of today?
Well, it's certainly a concern. It's a concern among my colleagues in the House and in the Senate. It's a concern among my constituents where this issue has certainly been on their minds. I get emails, I get letters, I get phone calls, you know, about the HJR that was moving through the House and the SJR that was moving through the Senate. And then on the last day of the session, last Friday, the House passed the Senate version of the bill that would actually put this resolution to the people on the ballot to actually change our Constitution here in the Missouri to define marriage as between one woman and one man, actually just to codify what we already have in statute.
So these are preventative or preemptive measures that are taking place. What do you think? Will we be looking at some form of gay marriage being proposed either down from the national level by, say, a Supreme Court decision, or up from the grassroots in Missouri in the near future?
Well, I think, we can expect both. And I think that the measures that we take as a legislature, as the people of the state of Missouri, I think that we have to confront this on many different fronts. I think that changing our Constitution through this SJR, where the people vote to change our Constitution, is a start. Now, the concern I would still have is that if we have an activist court in the state of Missouri, or if a case would go to the Supreme Court in Missouri, and the Missouri Supreme Court would uphold the constitutionality of the Missouri Constitution on this issue, then we always have the problem of it getting appealed to the federal court.
And what are your thoughts about the federal court's direction at this point in time? I mean, who can predict the future, but at this point in time on that issue?
Well, I can tell you this, that many of my colleagues and I have had long discussions on this, and especially at the state level. This is one of those issues, one of those watershed issues that I hope that your listeners would agree that those that they elect to represent them at the state level, would stand firm on and not blink. This is one of those issues where, if we pass a law in the House and in the Senate, and it goes to a vote of the people, and then the people change the Constitution, I would hope that this is one that we wouldn't blink on. This is one of those watershed issues that we just have to stand firm and say this is the way we want the law to be in Missouri, and what you do in the rest of the country, I guess, is not so much our business. But then at the federal level, I think that we also have to address it with our representation at the federal level.
Where are the Missouri voters on this issue, as far as you can tell?
As far as I can tell, in my district, the feedback that I've received, and I've gotten a lot of press on this issue, so I'm getting calls from outside my district, but the calls and emails I'm receiving, Todd, this is about a 90% issue. 90%, 9 out of 10 people that I hear have contact with on this issue support that we put into our Constitution the language we currently have in statute, that we define marriage in the state of Missouri between one man and one woman.
Have there been any informal straw polls or the like among the legislators there in Jefferson City, House or Senate, on this issue?
As far as where the members stand on the issue?
Yes.
Well, I can tell you this: the piece of legislation that came through on the House side earlier in this session, I believe we had 145 members out of 163, vote to send this to the ballot for the people, and I think when the Senate bill came through, the number was fairly the same, and on the Senate side, I think it was an overwhelming majority also, and what that tells me is, we are the representation of the people, the elected representation, and this is what our constituents are telling us they want.
What about your feel for the state courts and the Supreme Court of Missouri?
Well, I think that for the Supreme Court of Missouri, and I can say this with some confidence, I've had discussions with at least 3 of the Supreme Court justices here in Missouri. That would stand with us, on this issue. We've got one justice that is leaving, going to the federal bench, and I'll tell you, the next governor that we have in the governor's mansion is going to be a very important governor, because he is going to be, forming that court for the not too distant future.
And the present occupant of the governor's mansion, Bob Holden, where
right.
does he seem to stand?
Well, my indications would be that Governor Holden would probably be on the other side of the issue on us on this issue.
This is a presidential race year, of course, And it appears as though both presidential candidates, both George W. Bush and the presumptive Democratic candidate for president, Senator John Kerry, hold similar positions on gay marriage, being, at least in this respect, being against gay marriage, but in favor of some sort of civil union arrangement. Do you think it's going to be an issue coming November?
I think it will be an issue, and I think it'll be an issue both at the federal level and the state level. And as far as I'm concerned, as a conservative legislator, the best thing that could happen for me in my race is that that this issue would be on the ballot in November, because I really believe that it'll bring out the conservative base. So that is up to the governor. He can call a special election, put this on the ballot in August. We're hoping that it goes on the November ballot. But yes, I think at both levels it will be a very important issue. I think this is one of those issues that really defines our nation and our culture. And I know you know your history well, and of Western civilization, as do I, and civilizations that have ignored God's direction on this issue have morally crumbled from within.
Where do you expect the United States to be on this question 20 years from today?
Well, I think this, Todd, if the people don't come forth and let their will be known, and if the leaders of the people don't stand firm on this issue, I think that we will continue to have moral apathy, on this issue, and we'll continue down the wrong road. Everything is being, the idea of redefining marriage in this country actually comes from the Massachusetts courts and others saying that marriage is an evolving, paradigm. And I would disagree with that. I think it's a static institution, and it should remain that way. And if we don't have leaders that come forth and are willing, to stand for that, then I think that our nation will continue to go in the wrong direction.
Finally, Jim, why should Missourians oppose gay marriage? Make your case.
Well, because I believe that the institution of marriage between a man and a woman predates our Constitution. It predates our nation. It is the fundamental building block of any culture. And homosexuality and that mind, that worldview and mindset is a fruitless endeavor, and I think that that our God will bless a nation that stands firm on his precepts, and I know that that this is a bone of contention a lot of times with many theologians as far as God blessing a nation lives by and adheres to His word. But this is one of these areas, Todd, where I believe that we can come forth as a people and as leaders and show that that we as a nation put a value on this institution. And I think that if we do that, that in government, Todd, the things that you subsidize and endorse is what you get more of. And I think that if we put forth that the institution of marriage is something that we value, the marriage between a man and a woman, then that will get more of that, and that will encourage men and women to stay in wedlock. That will encourage people not to have babies out of wedlock. There's so many positive things that can come from us as a government endorsing and getting behind the traditional marriage covenant. And so I think that only good can come out of us standing firm, but I think that we could reap the whirlwind if we decide to go the other way.
Jim Lemke, thank you again for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
State Representative Jim Lemke of the 85th Legislative District in South County.
You can help change the world. Each of you has gifts to offer, and I am confident you will use those gifts where they are needed. I wish you well on the journey ahead. I thank you for the warm welcome and the honorary degree. I leave today a proud member of the Concordia University, Wisconsin class of 2004. May God bless you.
That's President George W. Bush speaking at a commencement on Friday at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin. Earlier today, I had an opportunity to talk with Dr. Pat Ferry. He's president of Concordia University in Wisconsin. I began by asking him, how in the world do you get the president of the United States to speak at your university's commencement?
There's a kind of a long answer and there's a short answer, right? The long answer includes a little bit of maneuvering here and there with people who know him and people who know us. But I think the short answer is as accurate, which is that we invited him and he accepted. Along with that, others have suggested that clearly Wisconsin is one of the key states in the upcoming presidential election. That may have had a lot to do with it. But the fact is there are lots of key states in this presidential election and many colleges among those states, and hundreds of people have invited him each year. So we're very fortunate out of those many hundreds of invitations that he agreed to come to Concordia.
Dr. Ferry, how was the president received during the commencement and his address in particular?
Well, in the anticipation of his arrival was extraordinary, and then when he finally came, his reception was incredibly warm. It was very, very positive, and I think he was quite moved by the reception.
What kind of preparations were necessary in terms of security to bring the president onto the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin?
Well, he leaves a big footprint wherever he goes, and we work closely with the White House teams, both the advanced team that was responsible for the staging of the event and the Secret Service that was responsible for security. And it all worked real smoothly. They're very professional, and at the same time, they were very careful not to intrude upon our ceremony in any way that was unnecessary.
I understand that an alumni of Concordia University, Wisconsin, was there in an official capacity as one of the Secret Service agents guarding the president.
I guess he was. I didn't see him, so he was definitely secret. But I understand that that he was among the team that was there, and there were quite a few of them.
The president was awarded an honorary degree as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, now, that's somewhat customary, though, although it doesn't happen all of the time, to present an honorary degree to a commencement speaker or other special guest. And our faculty and our board voted to award President Bush the honorary Doctor of Laws for his many contributions in government and service. It was very appropriate, and he was, I think, appreciative of that as well.
And what about the media and the press attention that this pulled on the day that the president spoke there?
Even before that, it's just been pretty much nonstop. Things have now, a couple days later, subsided a bit. But leading into it, and of course the day of, many, many media requests. And according to the White House folks, as many as 280 million people worldwide were aware of his presence on our campus, which of course is great for Concordia.
And I'm trying to get the picture in my mind of how this works when the president arrives. I'm familiar with your campus, having been there several times, but recently. And I'm picturing the presidential limousine and motorcade driving up the driveway. Is that how, and you waiting there at the steps to welcome it? Is that how it happened?
No, not exactly. Everyone was in place in the field house before he ever arrived on campus. There were no people outside waiting, and they brought him in through a back entrance to a reception of a few people who greeted him, and also the platform party, and then we brought him up to the stage. So it was, most of that was in areas of campus where you wouldn't ordinarily welcome guests. That's just the way they do it.
And how did you accommodate all the requests from family and whatnot? Obviously, people want to be there, uh-huh. want to be in attendance when the president's going to give the commencement address.
Right. We were able to double the capacity of our ordinary commencement with additional seats and bleachers so that we had 5,000 people who were in attendance. And although we didn't weren't able to provide seats for every single person who requested them, we did manage to give all of our graduates enough seats for themselves and the guests that they wanted to bring, as well as our current students and then many other special guests that we invited from the university.
Finally, Dr. Ferry, what in the president's address, obviously these kind of events can become a blur for everyone involved, but what in the president's address there at commencement Friday at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, still remains in your mind?
Well, this is, I guess, what I appreciate about it the most, and that was we had a fair bit of criticism ahead of time, I think primarily from folks who were of a different political persuasion who suggested that the university was being used as a campaign stop for the upcoming election. And I insisted all along that it was our expectation that this would be a presidential rather than a political visit. And his address was very much a presidential and commencement speech that was tailored specifically for our graduates. And to that end, he was really, I think, did a magnificent and exceptional job of challenge our students to, on the basis of their own strong Christian faith perspective, to have an impact in the world.
Dr. Pat Ferry, thank you for your time, and thanks again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Always a pleasure, Todd.
That's Dr. Pat Ferry, president of Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. We were talking about President Bush's commencement address on Friday there at Concordia University in Mequon. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is... Every year we've been doing a Books of the Month, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month, there's always one that stands out in my mind. I remember from last year, several that stood out in my mind. But this, I think, is going to be the one that stands out for 2004 as one of our Books of the Month. Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Jesus stands at the center of it all, and that is the essence. If you don't understand what being a Lutheran is all about, if you think it's about being German or being Finnish or being from Europe or singing old hymns, or if you think it's about Martin Luther or if you think it's about the Reformation, you're wrong. It's about Jesus. Jesus at the center of everything, not just Jesus getting honorable mention in our preaching and our practice and our singing and our praying, but Jesus at the center of it, Christ and Him crucified. Lots of churches will tell you that they're Christ-centered, but if it's not Christ-centered and cross-focused, you can have all sorts of false Christs being proclaimed under the banner of being Christ-centered. Christ your friend, Christ your coach, Christ your therapist. Very little Christ and Him crucified. That's what stands at the center of Lutheran theology, practice, teaching, preaching, worship. The book is called Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. It's written by a regular guest here at Issues Etc., Pastor Daniel Preuss. It's $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Get a copy for yourself by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Call them at 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find the book, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Visit one of Concordia Publishing House's two locations that they have here in St. Louis and pick up the book as well. 3558 South Jefferson, or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. When you walk in, look for the book, Little Black Book. Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Look for Luther's rose with the cross there at its center. Well, if I were in Massachusetts today, I would certainly have two conflicting responses, I think, or apparently conflicting responses. Sadness that one of the first states of the United States has taken the unprecedented move in an unprecedented way through rank judicial activism of introducing something unheard of before, at least in this form, the marriage of homosexual couples. I dare say the original representatives, the original founders, so many of them who held near and dear Massachusetts, could have imagined what was going on. Certainly the framers of the Constitution did not countenance something like gay marriage when it put together and articulated the many rights that are ours from our Creator. They didn't imagine this. But even if they did, that wouldn't make it right. even if they had written in a clause in the original Constitution allowing for the future adoption of something like gay marriage, if they would have put an amendment in the Constitution later in its life that said, you know, in anticipation of what may change in the future, we're going to say that marriage is not defined as a man and a woman, but we're going to pretty much say that marriage is whatever our culture will define it to be in the future. Let's say that they did that. Highly unlikely, but let's say they did it. It still wouldn't be right. So at the same time, I would be perhaps ashamed to be of Massachusetts on this day, but also perhaps hopeful. What else is going to present the question to our nation and going to force the hand of the church to step up in the public square and speak God's word to this issue than something like this? We can sit idly by and rest happily upon our laurels and our moral pronouncements and our theology when it's not being challenged in the public square. When it is, we are called to defend the faith once delivered for the saints, and as citizens in our various vocations to, as so many of our guests today have on this issue of gay marriage encouraged us to do, step out into the public square and do what citizens do in our society, and that's vote and speak. The founders were keen on providence, and there was obviously a limit to the way they viewed providence, far short of what Scripture speaks of when it talks about God's divine providence over all affairs of men. Sometimes in his providence, perhaps, he allows a nation to do this so that it won't do it in the future. That is yet undetermined. There in Massachusetts, some are celebrating and some are mourning, and across the nation, people are wondering, and they're anticipating that debate coming to a court near them. An earlier guest called it a watershed moment. That's what it is. It's a moment of decision on the part of the citizens of this country and on the part of the church. Will the church step up and say, no, speaking truth to power, even the power of the courts, and say, no, this cannot be. And make the case not only from God's word, but from sound logic in the public square, not only as Christians, but as citizens here. The American public says they don't want it. But we all often end up getting things we don't want, and then later, upon reflection, wondering why we didn't want it in the first place, going from yuck to yes to, well, so what? God preserve us from such apathy. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.